Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Moon, Moo, and You, the Collective Wisdom. My name is Kate Loving-Shank, and Joan Adams and I host the show. Dee Dee, Delaney, and Jala Magic are performing Act 2 of the Lunar Project, which is entitled Isis. I will allow Delaney to explain how he and Jala will do this Act 2 tonight, and I've extended the time to 90 minutes just so that nobody feels hurried or rushed. We don't have to go the full 90 minutes, but just, you know, so nobody gets all, but, you know, gets stressed out about it. But joining me now, and the call-in number is 347-205-9200, and joining me now is Joan Adams. Hello, Joan.
And good afternoon, Kate. I'm excited to hear Delaney again. This will be great.
I am, too. And Jala, too. That's exciting.
Yes,
hi, Dee.
Hi,
and Jala.
Hi, Joan.
Hi. How are you all?
Oh, we're doing fine. Jala is here, but she's not on the phone yet.
Yeah, that's cool.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, let me just check the chat room here and see if we have anybody in there. But people haven't called in to listen. But anyway, explain to us how you intend to do this tonight.
Okay, we may as well just launch right into it then. You can hear me okay?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, great. I guess I'll start by saying that I wrote this play, The Lunar Project, in the mid-1990s, so... Geez, that's almost 15 years ago. It is 15 years ago.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I can't believe it. It seems like it couldn't be that long ago, but it is. And I first performed it here in Norfolk, Virginia, where I live. It's a two-act, one-person play. I call it a stage tale, one word, because it's a tale that's told on the stage. each act culminates in a magical full moon experience. And that's why, part of the reason anyway, why I call it the Lunar Project. It's autobiographical, which means that these events really happened to me. Some of that may be unbelievable, but nevertheless. Now, on Moon, and You, the last June, I'll get it right, at the summer solstice, I performed the first act of the Lunar Project, which is entitled The Dog Star. And this evening... And we have to make note of this, the cusp of this year's powerful autumn equinox, where there is also happening a harvest full moon, and the full moon and the equinox are more often than not do not happen at the same time, but this week they do. So I'm going to perform then tonight the second act of the Lunar Project, which is entitled, as Kate said, Isis. And also tonight, Jala Magic, my wife, will perform her prologue to the Lunar Project, which is her moving dance poem, but you won't be able to see her dance, of course, called Incantation to Luna, okay? So, previously, as they say on TV, in Act 1, and some of you may recall who heard it, I recount how in the early 1970s, suffering from the trauma of my hippie dream falling apart when our commune at Funky Farm disintegrated, I ended up as a part-time janitor in a psychiatric daycare center. But Nita, the psychiatric nurse at the daycare center, lured me back to a party at Funky Farm, even though I was certain that Funky Farm didn't exist anymore. Well, not only did Funky Farm still exist, but as I discovered to my shock, the moon had a fire of her own. For that night, following a suggestion that came from I know not from where, I held my janitor's broom up into the full moon, and incredibly, the bristles heated up in the moon's rays, melted into a fiery ball, snapped off the broomstick, and soared into space to become fixed in the heavens as my guiding light, my star of my soul. Whew, talk about trauma. The event left me all but speechless. So Act Two, or Isis, begins a year or two after that, as my life began to settle down. But first, here is Jawa, to sanctify the airwaves with her incantation to Luna.
Oh, Mother, Goddess, Mare Luna, of most comfort to a daughter. She smiles down at me and is luminous, rosy pearls, jewel of the blue evening sky, jewel of the sea. She takes up and brushes my hair with wind, with water, her thousand hands caressing. She fans out my hair all around me in the sea, and I watch it with delight, streaming behind me like her own bright green seaweed, her waving grasses. She fills my eyes with light. She, whitest of all beings, white as that stone which has no name, and is silent. In silence, I hear her voice singing over me, rocking, rocking, rocking me as her own beloved child, her most beloved daughter. She fills me with such love that I melt into her sweetness, her song cradling me in the softest blue silk of her skies, bathing me in the deepest green of her waters. And my breath comes in and goes out, comes in and goes out, like the ebb and flow of her tides, in and out. And I drink of sweetness, her sweetness, Mother. I melt into her. I drown in her waters till she is me and I am she. Every motion, every dance, endlessly, endlessly infinite, always and forever alive.
Over the course of a few years, through the mid-1970s, I slowly settled down. The metaphysical shock and social dislocation of the preceding tumultuous war years seeped into memory, and I gained reasonable control of my reason and my circumstances again. My janitorial position at the psychiatric day care center expanded to include transportation aid. That's a fancy name for van driver. And my reputation took root in the community as a free-thinking writer, a maverick who readers of the independent press turned to, often nostalgically, when they wanted a dose of disrespect, mischief, or quirky psychic conviction. In the meantime, still living without television, I turned my mind in my spare hours to the study of esoteric philosophy. Now, what drew me to this fringe discipline was a desire to understand a series of surreal occurrences in my life over the recent several years. I'd begun to discover that there was an undeniable similarity between them and accounts of mystical experiences recorded throughout the ages, experiences that went down in the books as the visions and revelations of philosophy and religion. Well, if I'd been having those kinds of experiences, I reasoned, it was important for me to have confirmation of that. Well, then at least I might have a better idea of where in the human spectrum I belonged. Then, finally, I might be able to make some plans. I was 35 at the time, and I hadn't yet in my life been able to make plans. And as I pursued this study, I remained alert to discover if anyone else had ever noticed, as I had, that the moon has a fire of her own. My earliest inquiries on this subject were discouraging. Most of the writers I read dismissed the moon as barren rock, her illumination nothing but a reflection of the sun, a borrowed light. One gloomy writer, I remember, wished we could be rid of her altogether, calling her the sphere of hell, Earth's psychic cesspool. Only lightly, here and there, veiled in euphemisms, did I perceive any hint that a writer might believe the moon to exist in her own right, with her own energy source, her own purposes and laws of being. For this and other reasons, it became obvious to me that I needed to go more deeply into these subjects. I only wondered where to begin. Then, in the late 1970s, responding to a mail order advertisement in an occult publication, I acquired, at relatively low cost, a most remarkable book, exceeding all my expectations, where almost anything I'd ever want to know about Western metaphysical thought was either written or referenced. It's a well-worn book now, the binding of its cover held together with tape. When I first cracked open these weighty covers and began to read, college graduate that I am, with a strong liberal arts degree, I was astonished at what had been left out of my expensive education. Many revelations from the pages of this book soon opened my mind to whole new realms of thought. One of these concerned the Egyptian goddess Isis. Now, I've heard of Isis, of course. She's the sister and grieving lover of Osiris, you know, the really important one. But I never knew before that she was the same as Ishtar, Hathor, Maya, Demeter, Venus, and the divine Sophia of the poets and philosophers. She was even the same as the Virgin Mary. She was the great veiled goddess of the ancient Mideast. The great veiled goddess of the ancient Mideast. Well, frankly, I'd never heard of her before. Nor had I ever heard of her famous inscription. It was carved into the outside wall of a temple sacred to Isis on the Egyptian Isle of Sais. After identifying the goddess as the supreme being, which was nothing like I'd ever been taught before, not even in Unitarian Sunday school, it went on from there and said, "No mortal man has ever beheld my face." Beyond that, my book of knowledge said no more. But that sentence always stayed with me. It was a little like a fatal attraction. What could it mean? No mortal man has ever, ever beheld my face. In the early 1980s, having successfully completed a 3-year project on the ancient solar holy days, I announced with a touch of macho bravado that I would honor the feminine with a similar project embodying the ancient lunar mysteries. Now, I did not have a clear notion of what these lunar mysteries were, you understand, but I felt confident I could rely on the same approach I'd taken toward the solar project. I assumed that with a little research, I could construct a coherent outline and assemble enough essential information for my imagination to deduce the feminine reality. Well, unfortunately, I was wrong. For one thing, and a bit to my discomfiture, my admirable source book, my encyclopedic compendium of Western metaphysical thought, which I'd counted on to guide my search, barely mentioned any ancient lunar mysteries. Considering that the Great Veiled Goddess was associated with the moon, I wondered what sort of an oversight this might be. I searched elsewhere, in books by Joseph Campbell, Robert Graves, and others, learning only that significant information on this very mysterious subject did indeed exist, but in a record so fragmentary from a past so ancient that reconstructing a coherent system of practice and belief could only be guesswork. Well, unfortunately, I was having problems guessing. What information I could assemble, I could not synthesize in my imagination. It's in precise interpretation, like a beautiful but difficult poem, eluded my mind. It tantalized me, like the luscious fragrance of a ripe peach hanging in a tree, camouflaged behind a dazzling shimmer of sunlight and shade trembling through the leaves. Well, I knew it was there. I could smell it, but I could not discover it among the branches. Well, this put me a bit on the spot. My colleagues and supporters expected me to deliver some exciting new work. I anticipated that myself, but I was beginning to have feelings of foreboding that I might well fall short of expectations all around on this hastily conceived enterprise. Officially, my lunar project lasted 2 years. By the end of that time, I generated the hard copy, offered the product, delivered the thing that I said I was going to, and there was positive feedback for a lot of it, but overall, the result was too ambiguous, too murky for most people to enjoy, and, well, the project was not as successful or as well received as my solar project had been. Still, that might have been the end of it, except I could not recover my bearings. Foolishly, with no respect for its power to delude me, I'd strode forth into a lunar landscape, and whether the public noticed or not or cared, I had not found my way back. I was lost there, and I would remain lost there for another 6 years before help finally came. At the heart of the problem was my inability to comprehend the underlying essence of these female mysteries. My rational male consciousness, complicated, I admit, by certain vested sexual interests, fogged over and stalled, could penetrate no further whenever I attempted a coherent and unified explanation of the ideas I'd encountered, the ideas I'd expected to master in this hastily conceived enterprise. Now, foremost among these ideas was unconditional love, characterized by mercy, nurturance, compassion and caring, forgiveness, devotion to relationship. The great mother goddess of the lunar mysteries, it was said, would not endure the end of the world until all were saved. Oh, I found this idea quite beautiful and submitted to it, in fact, wholeheartedly. I was genuinely enthralled by this non-judgmental divinity standing so stark in contrast to the ill-tempered totalitarian god my countrymen all around me so constantly invoked. Yet, also part of essential feminine notions was this other idea that I could not reconcile with that. For clearly this ancient goddess was neither celibate nor prude. She did not stand above it all. Far from it. She was heavily, intensely involved in physicality, and, well, that included sex. She seduced lovers with music and incense, veils and oils. She conceived life and gave birth in blood and brine to time and everything in it. Sex was an integral part of her great maternal cycle, a critical phase of her identifying process. What my mind could not grasp was how a person, say, myself, would do that. Love unconditionally and sexually at the same time. I mean, it seemed like some kind of an ultimate thrill, but wasn't it impossible? You see, in those years of sexual revolution, the women I associated with and knew best were part of this growing goddess revival. Their idea was to resuscitate the ancient goddess as a model for modern womanhood, and high on that agenda, they were demanding to reclaim their bodies from millennia of sexual slavery. Well, I supported them on that. No one should be a slave, sexual, economic, or any other way. And, of course, I did not want to be turned out of my own beloved's bed because I was an oppressor. But just to maintain my relationship with a woman in those years, I was quite often expected to resign myself to sharing her with someone else, maybe several others. Ha! Countless others, the way it was explained to me, if I were courting the goddess herself. For in keeping with the goddess law of unconditional love for all, she would not, could not attach herself to a single lover in any kind of exclusive relationship. Oh, no. She belonged to all and all to her. She chose who she would for pleasuring forth the next generation. Now, in this system, a good man did not need the reassurance of monogamy as a base for his interactions with women. No, he was emotionally self-sufficient and spiritually mature, following that same law of unconditional love which governed her autonomy. He remained devoted and perturbed, no matter what choices his beloved made. He was equal to her liberated goddess nature, a kind of solar priest, adequate for a lunar priestess. Well, I tried to live up to that. I sincerely believed it was right, but practicing my belief was torture. Despite all my will to the contrary, I most ended up feeling hurt, abandoned, martyred like a sacrificing saint whenever I tried to give unconditional blessing to my beloved's emotional and sexual liberation. Only rarely, for no cause I could ever predetermine at will, did I feel secure enough to enjoy so generous and expansive a mood. The rest of the time, I couldn't do it. To love so intensely, so intimately, as seems to be the case with sexual love, then to feel glad for her as she hops in her sedan and drives away to resume her independent life, to return as my lover again, perhaps never? Oh, this contradiction, this paradox between the noble ideal of unconditional love as I understood it and the possessive, self-centered reality of sexual love as I found it in myself and in others, increasingly clouded my lunar project with doubt and confusion. Worse, I began to manifest serious relationship problems with several lunar priestesses, leading to a major disruption in my domestic life. At the same time, predictably, I ran out of money, my material support. I spent the better part of a year living in and out of my car, still groping for the resolutions I needed to discharge my goddamn lunar project. during that time, I ended up supporting myself as a field worker on an ornamental tree farm. Some of my co-workers were ex-convicts. It was hard, punishing work, which brought on some long-term physical problems for me in my spine, my hips, and my feet. Well, no doubt to compensate for my wavering ego identity, I imagined myself in those years as duty and honored bound to a kind of latter-day indigenous vision quest, enduring great loneliness and material sacrifice in order to gain the self-knowledge and mastery required to fulfill the ideal of feminine love. But that extreme sentiment was emotionally normal for me. Oh, I'd always been obsessively romantic, particularly when it came to women. Hey, I was Romeo. I was Antony. I was the lover of Annabel Lee. I easily imagined myself choosing a fateful sacrificial path to oblivion rather than relinquish my starry-eyed notion of some ideal love. In this case, embodied in the sublime principles of the eternal feminine, whatever exactly they might be. So I stumbled along for several years, seeking the synthesis essentially between lust and chivalry, until I was quite played out. Finally, I thought, to hell with this. The goddess is still my divinity of choice, even if I were too emotionally immature to qualify as the hero priest of hers. I'd just forego all that. That's what the big guys were for, the free agents who had conquered their infantile emotions. For my part, I found it much more relaxing just to be pals with a woman, and sadder but wiser. Stripped of any sense of my superior advantage in this whole realm of inquiry. That's just the attitude I adopted. And the more that attitude settled into my consciousness, the more stable my personal life became. I moved back home. Before long, I'd regained my financial footing as well. And though I still did not understand her paradox, though I could not comprehend all or even most of who or what she was, I became something of a devotee of the great veiled goddess. I saw her as having a seat in the moon and followed her phases each month. I observed her annual dance with the sun, one of the truly big guys. It's gliding south as he leaps north for summer. She glides north to crown the zenith of our winter nights as he dips south. At the equinoxes, they meet cheek to cheek. How I wished I could have heard the secrets they whispered then. Oh, it was no formal thing. I didn't go to any goddess circle meetings or pagan worship weekends in the mountains, but I accepted her as a living force in the cosmos, an unseen presence who interceded for me in my follies or supported me in my noble efforts. I particularly recognized her as the all-inclusive spirit who feeds and animates nature from the least speck of an insect in the sand, to that looming colossus himself of the earth, that dubious wonder we call man. Oh, and as for sex, that was her secret. Well, I remained curious, of course, but I now accepted limits, put myself under old-fashioned restraints. She would have to surprise me one day with an unexpected initiation if she ever wanted me to understand that mystery. I would fool with the hot coil no more. And so several more years passed. And though I knew there was an incompletion in me, undermining my perfect contentment, I became very busy. And for the first time in my life, relatively prosperous in the world. Then, in 1987, my mother died. It was August 13th. That happens to be the same day as the feast of the ancient goddess Diana. In Christianity, it's the same day as the death of the Virgin Mary. My mother had an uncanny way of positioning herself significantly. Anyway, according to her wishes, my father made arrangements to have her body cremated. Several days after her death, we received her remains from the funeral parlor. They came in a plain, stiff, cubic foot cardboard box. It was a bit disconcerting to open the box and find a clear plastic bag inside, stuffed fat with ashes and closed with a twisty. I didn't know whether to laugh or take offense at this unceremonious presentation, and I guess I did both. Of course, I had to pull the baggie out of the box and have a closer look. It was eerie. I mean, in one way, it was nothing. It reminded me of a bag of kitty litter. But in another way, I could recognize my mother in those ashes. The coloration, the pale whites and grayish tinges, the odd flecks of green and yellow and rust scattered throughout the mass reminded me of her physical presence, as if these were the colors rendered to their pristine essence in the fire that had tempered the very essence, the very aura of her once living body. Yes, it was eerie. I put the baggie back in the box and closed it up. What are you going to do with them? I asked my father.
I don't know.
But a few weeks later, when I was planning to take off for a couple of days at the seashore, he drew me aside.
I wanted to ask you. I think I'd like to have the ashes scattered in the ocean.
I found myself unusually electrified. I couldn't have said why, but that was just what I would have wanted.
Is that a possibility for you while you're down there?
Yes. I knew several places, isolated enough, where I thought I could get away with something like that.
Would you want to do it?
I'd be glad to do it, I replied, without hesitation. I regarded it, in fact, as a high honor, a kind of sacred commission. I don't know, I think it was the only one I remember my mortal father ever entrusting me with. A few days later, I and my wife, Jala, arrived at the spot on the mid-Atlantic we'd discovered several years earlier and escaped to now as frequently as possible, never often enough. Here in this haven, this sacred site, acres of state-protected forest and wild dunes surrounded miles of virtually deserted beaches around a prominent cape where the bay merged with the ocean. Birds from the entire Western Hemisphere stopped here for nest and rest on their migratory flights, and dolphins in great numbers congregated in the waters just offshore. Aside from a few sport fishing boats or pleasure craft, few ships blocked the view across the sea to the horizon. The tourist trade hadn't quite claimed this spot yet, because middle-class families had not yet resorted to camping. Then came the white-collar recession of 1991, and with it an explosion of people with new, fancy camping gear, noisy kids on skateboards and bikes, and a chorus of whining for concessions in the parking lots, boardwalks over the dunes to the beaches. That place is no longer a viable getaway for us, but it still was then. Our first day, a Thursday, came up sunny and warm in the campground, so we never doubted it would be a good beach day. As planned, we'd arrived ahead of the influx of weekend campers. We expected a day of relative privacy for dispersing the ashes. At the beach, though, we were surprised by a fairly stiff, cold wind blowing in from the ocean, making it uncomfortably chilly. Fortunately, I located a spot in the dunes out of the wind where we could lay low and stay warm. We spread out our towels and settled there. With us, we had an inflatable raft,
a thermos of iced tea, a bottle of water for our new puppy, She Honey, and, of course, the box. Because of the chill wind, I didn't feel much like plunging into the rough and rolling water. So we sunbathed for a long time, except for some walks we took with the pup. I suppose I might have put off the mission until the next day, but I preferred to do it, have it off my mind, if only the wind would die down. But by mid-afternoon, the wind still hadn't died down. At this rate, with the sun sinking toward evening, it could only get more chilly. Still, there was one advantage. Except for newcomers who didn't stay long, the wind had driven nearly everyone else off the beach. We had just about total privacy. I sat and thought about what I had come to do. It seemed simple enough when I promised my father I'd do it, but now I had to admit I felt a bit unnerved. I mean, my mother's ashes. And my plan was not well formulated. I'd envisioned paddling out some distance on the raft and then, well, opening the baggie and dumping out the ashes, but they were surprisingly heavy, maybe 8-10 pounds. In a rough sea, on a flimsy rubber raft, well, this might not go as smoothly as I'd imagined. Still, if I was going to do it, the time had come. It was around 4 o'clock, and the sun and the dunes had begun casting some long shadows our way, warning us about as much as he was going to that day. I stood up. Well, I said, going to do the deed, Jala asked. Going to do it. With the baggie in one arm, Talon's sweatshirt under the other, and the raft dragging along by a rope, I walked down to the sea. I left my things on the shore and waded into the water, holding the raft steady in front of me as I pushed it through the churning breakers. Setting my cargo aboard, I sprang off the sandy bottom onto the raft, wriggling my weight about until I managed to stabilize myself and my stomach, the baggie trapped beneath my chest. Then I began paddling with my hands out to sea. The waves came at me continuously from all directions. To avoid capsizing, I had to keep adjusting my balance back and forth on the raft, now this way, now that. Finally, I reached what seemed an appropriate distance from shore. I don't know how far it really was, 50, 100 yards. Anyway, I eased myself up to straddle the raft like a horse. Under my weight, it sagged in the middle like a grin. I kept the baggie tucked between my thighs as I rose and fell like a seabird in the unpredictable heave and toss of the waves. I looked around. Water in motion everywhere. White caps spitting. Distant shore. Vast dome of sun-drenched sky, a few curious gulls wheeling over my head, and the wind. It warbled in my ears with a ceaseless blow and blasted me in gusts like bellows. This, I remember thinking, is a really strange trip. Oh, well, how was I going to go about it? If I tried to tip the baggie's weight over and dump it out, I foresaw myself losing my balance and pitching over into the water. I wanted this to be a ceremony, not a farce. So I decided to leave the baggie where it was, open it, and empty it in handfuls. Careful, to keep from rocking too much, I removed the twisty, reserved it in my teeth, and, too late for regrets, I plunged my hand into the bag and scooped up the fistful of the dry, sun-warmed ashes. Some were soft, like powder. Some were in small, hard particles and chips. I brought this first fistful out of the bag, and with a sweep of my arm like a theatrical priest, I flung a cloud of ashes out over the water. Oh, no! The wind blew them right back in my face and all over my chest and belly, even over my lap. They stuck to me because I was wet. Damn. What could I do but proceed? I scooped out another fistful, flinging it downwind this time to avoid as much of the blowback as I could. this worked better. And so I continued, handful after handful, flung into the air and blowing past me and away into the sea. Finally, grabbing the baggie by the bottom, I shook out the last of the load all around me. By then, I was covered with ashes. It went with the job. They were in my hair, in my eyes, in my ears and mouth, all over my body, and floating over the raft like sediment over a jetty. Holding on to the empty baggie, the twisties still in my teeth, I rolled over into the water and washed it all off me, off the raft, out of the plastic, even out of my bathing suit. Then I started back toward shore. I was in a daze, a little bit in shock. What had I done? Jala met me with my towel as I waded out of the surf. She told me that the sun, shining through the ashes, made rainbows over my head as I'd flung them, like spirits being released into the air. I nodded. It was something else, I said. While I'd been doing it, my mind had been sharply focused on the logistics of the act, like keeping my balance on the raft or flinging the ashes in the most effective way. But subliminally, I'd been aware of much more, which only came more clearly into my mind later. I was aware of a certain kind of yelping ecstasy in the act, of a communion with the sky and the sea and my mother's spirit that was totally celebratory and triumphant, a sacred joy. But I was also aware of the symbolic implications of what I was doing, casting these remains of my personal mother into the Mother Ocean, into the great eternal sea, performing a ritual so ancient, so primitive that its origins remain buried in my subconsciousness. And I was aware of certain dark social implications, disposing of my own mother's corpse in a manner that, for many people, crosses the barbed wire borders of taboo. And then, of course, to round out everything, there was the edible factor. We decided to leave the beach around 6 o'clock. As I stooped to gather up my towel, I felt a sharp, insistent prick in my bathing suit on the underside of my testicles. This is the truth. I opened my suit, reached inside, and extracted a single, tiny, white and brittle triangular chip of, well, what else could it be? Mother's bone. It was her last physical contact with me, that parting prick. Not missing the irony, I flicked the chip into the sand. I thought about my mission all that night by the campfire, with the moon and Jupiter prominent in the night sky. Big thoughts about the mother. Not all of them soothing. But the next morning, soft and very warm in a balmy, gentle breeze, there came to me a thought about what my mission had accomplished, which pleased me intensely and settled into my belly as conviction. It superseded all the other thoughts I'd had on the subject. I thought, well, my mother is everywhere now, in the sky, in the sea, in the earth, everywhere. And by being everywhere, she is always with me, from all directions and in all things. Now, I thought, I'm always home. Now, my mother is the universe, herself. A year passed. We made it back to our beloved seashore spot several times the following summer. But the most memorable was for only 36 hours, 2 days and one night, the night of August 28th, 1988. There was a full moon in Pisces that night, the compassionate moon. But the weather had been unsettled, raining on and off all day, atmosphere hot and oppressively humid with sultry winds swirling all about. I wondered if the clouds would clear enough for us to see the full moon. We'd eaten a cold supper around 8 o'clock as dusk settled in. Jala climbed into the back seat of the car for a cat nap while I cleaned up. It was about an hour after dark by the time I'd finished. I walked out from under the trees at the campsite to the road for a better view of the sky. Now the moon was up. Despite a bank of heavy clouds blocking the sky to the east, I could see a band of her light leaking through. Very possibly she could rise above those eastern clouds and show herself. I decided to hoist myself up on the hood of our car, lean back against the windshield, and watch the sky, observe my environment for a while, commune with it. The trees around me swayed ceaselessly in the hot wind. The tall pines and oaks, the sassafras saplings and bayberry shrubs. A few neighbors spoke of campfires in the night. Somewhere, familiar voices sang a song to a popular guitar. It was a night of dreams, interrupted only by the headlights of a car swinging around to or from one of the campsites. I soon incorporated them into my reverie, even the damn high beams. Halfway into a meditative trance, I watched as the moon slowly ascended out of the murky east. Above the stationary cloud bank, in a glow of soft celestial triumph cast before her, her moonlight brightened the swirling mists. The sky took on a luminescence that seemed to stop time. The very night itself seemed to hold its breath, focused in a mystical stillness as this rare moment of stunning drama and beauty played out in utter silence for all the world to see just by looking up. And then, at last, the moon, unfolding in infinite grace like a bloom, slipped her head above the clouds in rich veil spun from the mists in white and rose and gold. Oh, she looked like a mystical egg. Now I understood how she had become the seat of the great virgin goddess. In her veiled, milky beauty, she was like the womb of all mystery. She was a knockout. And as she rose above the clouds, a tremor passed through the trees, and from their upstretched boughs, ghostly flames of vaporous etheric energy leaped skyward toward her as if in a greeting. I'd been watching this over our recent visits here, though I'd never noticed it in previous years. All the trees, but especially the pines, had a way of communicating with the moon, of telling her their news. I'd watched it go on all night one time while she was up, and I understood then that what I observed took place on the thoroughfares of the cosmic community, from which man has so long excluded himself that he no longer recognizes its existence. Tonight, the trees were particularly charged and exuberant. They shot their messages aloft like beams of lightning, so electrifying the night that strands of thought flashed across the sky like early warnings of a coming lunar storm. So I passed the time watching the sky till Jala woke up. We planned to go out dancing that night at a place we enjoyed where reggae music played on an open deck overlooking the bay. But first, I had to let the water out. I slid off the hood of the car, whistled for She-Honey, and began walking across the campsite. As I climbed a knoll at the campsite's far end, She-Honey cut out ahead of me into a clearing that sloped away from the campground. I followed her. The sand was aglow in reflected moonlight. The trees and shrubs were animated shadows in the wind. I looked up Much of the mist had cleared from the moon by now, though a few strands and patches of clouds, hurried along by the wind at their backs, still played across her. And then something happened. It was a certain pattern of clouds. They formed and drifted across the moon from the south on my right to the north on my left. But because of the particular configuration they were in, because of the impressionistic wash of haze across the sky, perhaps most of all because of the mystical aura of the entire night, suddenly the moon was not just the moon, but distinctly, unmistakably, a lady's face, slowly turning from south to north, taking in all creatures from one end of the planet to the other. Instantly, I was mesmerized, riveted to the spot where I stood, my eyes locked on her. She wore a glad, pretty, almost girlish, gay smile with which she greeted us, the populace below on Earth. I fell in love with her at first sight. But as she turned her head, I then realized that her eyes, as they swept the vista of her vast domain, were set on a course toward the very spot where I stood. Oh, no! Would they rest on me? Single me out? I felt as nervous that she might see me as that she might not. All around me, the trees had gone wild. Their emanations of energy leaped skyward like deafening cheers, while in the world of the normal human senses, the silence was profound. On the streets of the cosmic community, hallelujahs and hosannas rang out to the skies in praise of the Queen of the Night as she reviewed her creation. And then, indeed, her eyes I guess a kind of impersonal, benevolent affection in her eyes, like the saints in Sunday school pictures or Bible movies who are generically kind to everyone. That's what I imagine the nature of unconditional love to be. I assumed, I think, that her affection would gloss over me, only one of anonymous billions of onlookers, all equally esteemed. I must confess, I would not have been surprised had her affection, her glance, fallen on me with a little less approval than on all the rest. But what I did not expect, what I was completely unprepared for, was her recognition. She knew me. Well, you know what that look of recognition is in someone's eyes who knows you. Imagine if that recognition were complete, intimate knowledge of you. Imagine total affection, total unqualified delight for who and what you are, as if all your presumed weaknesses and downfalls never even existed. Imagine this complete intimate knowledge, this total affection, this unqualified, unconditional love burning with passion for you. And then, imagine that it's all coming from a great big face that has just formed in the sky. Oh, it was almost terrifying. I could not have borne that glance for more than a single second, but she did not require that. Her eyes moved on. Her head continued to turn toward the north, completing her review of her realm from pole to pole, blessing each and every creature who met her gaze, firing each soul with the same passionate devotion to its integrity as she had shown for mine. And then, suddenly, she was just the moon again. What had I seen? Not an hallucination, yet certainly no ordinary reality of the natural world either. No, no, it was something between these two, as if time had suddenly opened up for a moment in a parting of the veil, and the incredible face behind it shone through. Never had I seen a face like that before, and yet somehow, somewhere, I had too. I recognized her too. In fact, however I knew, there was no doubt. It was she. It was the goddess. It was the great mother. Unveiled. Well, that was the point. Utterly unveiled, as if naked. Stark naked in all her breathtaking beauty. Until the moment I saw her with my own eyes, it had been incomprehensible to me. I'd been incapable of understanding. But now I understood. There is no contradiction. Those who love unconditionally love with the white, hot passion of a forge. It's the kind of love few dare to go for. And then I remembered that strange inscription carved into the wall of the Temple of Isis at Sais. No mortal man has ever beheld my face. What could that mean? I beheld her face, that much I know. I'm a mortal man. Or am I?
Yay! Clap, 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 clap.
Thank you.
No, that's really cool.
Thank you.
Especially since now we can all practice looking at the goddess tonight as she rises in her pool. That's pretty heavy. And
yes,
Jupiter,
right.
Too. Jupiter,
huh?
Jupiter has never been so close to the Earth. As,
really?
In the last so many years. So that will be a spectacular sight. Hi, Della. Are you still there, June? We might have lost her.
I thought I heard her. I thought I heard a buzz. I heard a buzz.
That was really something else to think about. Everything.
Yes.
Well, good. That's what it's for.
Yes.
It is. To make everybody kind of stop and pause and look around a little more deeply.
Well, instead of just looking at the moon and saying, hey, that's the moon.
Yeah.
And then, you know, just go in the house again or whatever. You know, life is so much more intense than most people realize.
Yes.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
And I've noticed that because, well, I've always thought that, but, you know, as you know, I've been writing these prayers every day.
I love your prayers, Kate.
Do you? Almost 360 days.
No kidding.
I have 30 more. November the 1st.
Oh, so you're almost done with it.
Wow.
Yeah, you're getting up there to almost the first year. Are you going to keep going then?
Well, I'm not going to do weekends anymore because I've been tracking traffic and everything. And also, I work weekends and I work nights. And I'll come home and... Right, if I have a chance to scribble off a prayer and I come home and type it, I fall asleep over the computer.
Very beautiful, Kate.
I really appreciate that.
Yeah.
I do appreciate that.
Know. It's quite a collection. I mean, I think you could publish them.
Yes.
Well, we had Deborah Levin Herman on our show. She's a New York agent, publisher type person. And the only reason we had her on the show was not to talk about the prayer or anything. I think Joan brought it up, though, that dear soul. And she said that could easily be published.
Oh,
yeah,
God, yes.
I believe that.
Yeah,
there's a lot of inspirational books like that.
I would take
not
some
really
stuff out.
Good. Yeah.
I mean, I could rewrite some of them so that they're not promoting, a lot of it, some of it is promoting the show, the Moon Moon You show or promoting this or promoting that. But that usually can be just taken right out and rewritten.
Yeah. Well, that's great.
I don't know.
Very intense.
Yeah, so, I mean, in writing those prayers, I have felt that exactly what you're talking about in this play, yeah. And we should tell our listening audience, too. You know, I made this 90 minutes, by the way, just because I didn't want you to feel strained or stressed.
Oh, thank you.
To hurry. And
we
go ahead.
To get it in, but, yeah, we can stay on if there's, you know, people want.
Well, we can discuss it, though.
Yeah.
I don't know if anybody, I'm actually outside, and the computer be damned at this moment. Anyway, I just wanted to say that, you know, there's so much that we can do to deepen our awareness about life.
Yeah.
And that's why I would want to stop writing those prayers, because I'm afraid I'd start reverting back to some sort of stupid lifestyle of not being aware. I think awareness is the key word for me. It has been for a while. Yeah.
It's very easy to go back to sleep. I don't know if you ever reach a point where you no longer have that danger, but it's very easy to go back to sleep.
And that's what I'm saying, Yeah, me too, but we're all a little older now.
Yeah, it helps, you know, as you get older, you know, you have less to lose in a way.
Yeah, less time, too.
Yeah, right. You start to think you start to think about more ultimate and eternal things.
Exactly, and I think that's what happens that's what's supposed to happen to humans as they get older, and that they calm down and they get slowed down, and a lot of young people misinterpret that slowing down.
Especially in our country, you know, where we worship youth.
Yeah, not only that, but the older people misinterpret it too. They think that, oh my God, I'm getting old, and that there's nothing wrong with that.
That's
I hate
true.
That.
Well, you don't get too much respect, you know, for getting old. I mean, you're sort of kicked to the sidelines anyway.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, really in the society.
Yeah,
in this society, right.
Yeah. I mean, even in so-called more enlightened circles, you know, there's still, like, a prejudice against age. You know, it's not as wide, maybe, as on TV and in commercials and everything, but, you know, but there is, you know, I mean, this idea that, you know, that as you get old, you get kind of useless. You're not able to, you know,
contribute
or fight. There's so much emphasis on fighting everything, you know. I mean,
they can't
to help.
Yeah. Well, they can't send you to war anymore.
That's one great relief. You can't be drafted, at least not yet. But
we're
fighting wars around the world, I suppose, after
a
while. There's a joke that runs around in the internet that they ought to just draft old men to fight in the war.
Yeah, because then maybe people would respect them or something.
Well, it probably they wouldn't bother.
Yeah.
But anyway, but yeah, it's.
And then the matter of death that
right.
comes up very vividly in this.
Yeah.
People are
small
so.
Yeah,
the small matter of death, the small matter of aging and becoming useless to American society. And these things, I think, the baby boomers have a perfect opportunity.
Yes.
And so do the younger people. I mean, everybody has the perfect opportunity to break out of this bullshit.
Yeah.
And it can be done, and I think the internet community, the ones I am interested in, are all engaged in this sort of enlightening kind of thing.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah, I think so, too. I see a lot of stuff that comes to me on the internet that is very upbeat.
Yeah, very, very much so.
Yeah, and hopeful and excited about the future, which, you know,
you
don't find so much in the political sphere.
No, politics is pretty bullshitty, too. I mean, there's no sense even listening to that.
Yeah, well, I think
it's a downer, you know.
It is, you know, but at the same time, I'm not entirely sure how to balance politics or participating in community on the political level with the spiritual stuff, because it does bring you down, and it is politics does, and it is a win or loser thing, you know, and it puts you in this phony competitive sort of atmosphere or whatever arena, this competitive arena. But at the same time, you know, decisions are made in politics that impact us all tremendously.
Yeah, that's right. We have to be aware of that once again.
Yeah, right.
Don't want to just go to sleep and just pretend it doesn't exist, right?
I know. It's a tricky one.
Yeah.
But
well, we had a woman on the show one time who writes what is called the Good News Gazette, and she was very passionate. And I think what she plans to do over time is what she does. She and her boyfriend, and she is young too. She's young. Mm-hmm. They scour the internet and find upbeat articles, and that's what they put in their newsletter.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
You guys could look it up. You just Google it, you know.
Yeah.
And
all right.
And most of what they get it from is the Christian Science Monitor.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that's where most of those things come from. But I think what they plan to do in the future, the two of them, and maybe get a whole staff of people who start writing their own stuff about their own vision, you know, about what the life should be. And that's a new paradigm, because politics,
yeah.
I know I got involved in, our friend Jerry Polakoff is running for the 41st Congressional District here in Lancaster.
Lancaster, yeah.
And got involved in that, and I couldn't believe the backbiting and then all of a sudden they call the guy he's running against, and I'm sure I can't imagine what he calls Jerry, but anyway, they call them Jerry's opponent, and
that's
just not where I want to be. So I kind of have
it's like a boxing match or something.
Yeah, a spectator sport.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, sports imagery is really, you know, it's almost the favorite metaphor for politics. Sports imagery.
And I do admire Jerry quite a bit, because he's totally a progressive candidate. He believes in single payer. He believes in women's rights. He believes in all the things that we would want a politician to believe in.
Yeah.
And as far as the Sarah Palins and McDonald woman goes, you know, they are helping the progressive movement, I think, because
I hope so. I hope they're not just going to get elected. I've been astonished ever since Reagan about the people who got elected. I never believed that I never believed America would elect, you know, a Ronald Reagan, and then they did. And I certainly never believed they'd elect George W. Bush, and they did.
And then they did.
And then
it could be that they will elect these women. And the point of the matter is that. I don't know why this would happen. I mean, I know what I was going to say. The news is emphasizing their utter stupidity and this and this and this. And well, her supporters are not being swayed by any of this. They believe the more she gets maligned, the more her supporters back her. I think people should step away and stop, maligning her, because it's going to backfire.
That's right. It has an opposite effect.
Yeah, they get more passionate about it, and I think it also attracts other people who might not otherwise be attracted to supporting her.
Yes,
so
people
start to feel a little bit, you know, you might start to feel a little sorry for, especially for her, for this O'Donnell woman who's really a trip.
Oh my gosh! I mean, she said, "Oh well, everybody in their teenage years." Had something to, had something to do with Satanism and witchcraft. I thought, what the heck is she talking about? You know, the stuff
right.
comes out of her mouth is unbelievable.
Unbelievable, but the thing is that people are relating to it. Like it's, maybe it's true.
I guess, yeah, maybe they do. I don't know.
Yeah.
All this, punitive God stuff. You know, the punitive God.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens, I guess. I like to step sort of over all that and look at things that are more permanent, you know, or more, I don't know about permanent, but
like God.
I'd like to take a more eternal view, you know, like
yeah. The
next election, you know, there have been so many elections, but there's what, you know, what's enduring, what's, you know, and I think, you know, that's when you get into spirituality and that sort of thing, you don't necessarily have to have the same words that other people have to describe your spirituality, but I think at the bottom, every spiritual person, no matter what church or, you know, wherever they, you know, where they go to worship or whether they go nowhere to worship, but every person who has spirituality is in a general agreement.
Yes.
About you know, how to behave in a way, you know, toward each other. And
yeah.
And that's the point.
That is the point. It's like the golden rule.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's in every religion. And people that break it consciously or well, you can always point it out, you know. Jesus says, love your enemies. So what are we doing fighting these wars, you know? I mean, I did ask a Methodist man at our church that one time. And he basically said, you know, you had to break that rule. but the point was, you know, he said you had to break it. You know, it'd be nice if you could love your enemies, but that's not the way it is. Well, okay, so then you're not really practicing your Christianity, are you?
No.
Well, no, not really.
Right.
You know,
right.
That's kind of the way I think. You know, that if we all really, really just practice our religions, you know, just really, really worked at it, we're not going to be perfect most of the time or all the time, certainly, but you know, just keep those things in mind. You know, things I think, you know, beyond, you know, I think we could, and I don't see why we can't do that, you know, I really don't. It seems pretty simple.
Actually, there's a few people on the line here. Let me bring them on.
Oh, great.
Hello, Joan. We lost you.
Yes, you did. Well,
oh,
I lost my connection,
on.
And then I came back and couldn't get your attention because you were outside. But
no, I thought.
What happened? Did you lose the program?
I lost it for a minute because my portable phone died, and I went to get the other phone, and in the meantime, I lost it, so I had to redial back in. But I heard it, and I thought it was fabulous.
Thank you.
I was more into your mother's part of that. I just thought all that was kind
of
cool.
Yeah, a lot of people relate to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. you know. But, yeah.
So it is amazing. Oh, I was saying, Joan, the experience of the moonrise tonight and the moon being full with the
beautiful night.
It's
going to.
And in
Pisces, by the way.
The moon is in Pisces tonight.
Oh, I thought it was going to be full moon in, whatchamacallit, in Virgo.
Yeah. Yeah, but
that's what they said.
Not until Thursday, I think. Thursday evening.
So tonight is the full moon.
Well, it's full. You know, you consider the full moon to be five days, really. 3 days before and 2 days after is what the astrologers say.
Okay.
So we've got really 3 days of the full moon in Pisces and 2 days of the full moon in Aries.
Wow,
so
this is
a pretty
cool.
That's a pretty big sweep. And,
yes, it is.
Yeah, that's. I mean, and then at the equinox, which doesn't happen every year, and so, you know, wow.
Oh, I know.
Plus the sun, Sheila probably had all this on. I didn't hear that last time, but the sun, of course, is opposing the Jupiter-Uranus conjunction in the end of Pisces. So it's wacko, you know. I mean, you know, we're really getting hit with some strong cosmic energy right now.
I know. Isn't that exciting?
It is.
Yeah, there are a lot of exciting things happening.
Yeah. I think the world is changing. Well, you know, I don't want to get too bubblehead about it, but I really think that the world is changing for the better right now.
Yeah, me too.
I see more people expanding in their awareness and their concerns than I've ever seen before.
Oh, I know.
Than I've seen for a long time. I think the same thing happened in the 60s.
Yeah.
We've been waiting for a long time for the 60s to come back.
Well, let's look at it this way.
Huh?
Let's look at it this way. it was only the one summer, the summer of love. And now we can go for eternal love. That's my theory.
Right.
Yeah.
Got a lot of time now.
That's right.
So, you'll be joining us in December for the third act.
No, there is no third act.
Yeah, oh, okay.
That's it. I was wondering,
December,
maybe you wanted to replay the Christmas Carol from last year.
Yeah. Yes.
Replay it like as in the archives.
But you know, in other words, just do it. Do the one we did last year. Do it.
I don't know how to do that.
Just do it again.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure how to do it. Well, we could ask somebody in the meantime.
Well, I mean, I could come on and do it, but I was just thinking that maybe it'd just give us all a break.
Well,
and you could listen to it yourself.
Yeah.
Say again?
You could listen to it.
I could listen to it, right?
Yeah, you could listen to it, yeah.
Yeah.
That's an awesome thing.
Our friend 2020 would be able to help us with that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I could do it again, too. I mean, it'll be a little different, probably better. But
you sound... I don't know if you've improved your microphones or whatever, but it's very clear tonight.
Oh, good.
And have you? Have you changed anything?
No.
No. Same old kitchen telephone.
I got more used to doing it in a telephone. Maybe it's that.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it was a little bit different last Christmas. It was a little more distant, I would say.
Yeah. Well, I don't know why that would have been, but... Possibly it's the way I held it. I don't know.
It could be.
Yeah, I don't know why. But anyway, we could just do it again. You know, I could do it. I could. We'll see.
Well, we'll never get tired of that.
No.
Yeah, good. Yeah, right.
That was
definitely doing it around here again this year.
You will be, won't you?
Yeah.
Everybody loves that. My gosh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was probably the most popular one that I did on your show.
Yeah, I would think.
You know, people love Christmas, don't they? My gosh.
Yeah, I love Christmas.
Yeah.
It's really fun.
Well, it's one of the few times a year we slow down enough to really enjoy, you know, something like that.
That's what it is, isn't it?
Stops all the flying around and everything and actually sit and enjoy some real talent. Yes.
Yeah.
Lights. I love the Christmas lights.
Yeah, a lot of the
world. Oh, I do too.
Yeah, people have to sort of take a break, even if they don't want to.
Right. Right.
Well, it's expected of them to take a break.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. It's different. It's a different time. We really should have Christmas all year.
Oh my gosh!
Starting really early. The first performance he has is November 12th.
Oh, my gosh.
Really?
At one of the historic houses here. And, you know, they have all these historic houses. And he's going to be performing there. People are coming in for a formal tea, a high tea.
Oh!
The entertainment will be the Christmas Carol.
Sweet.
It's a Dickens celebration of some kind. They're doing four of them. I'm going to do Christmas Carol four times in this place.
Wow.
Oh, isn't that going to be fun?
Yeah.
Make a little money, too.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's important.
Yeah.
That helps.
Did you hear our conversation, Jen, about the false beliefs or the negativity surrounding getting older?
Yeah, I did hear that. And, of course, you know I'm totally on the opposite side politically from where y'all are. But, yes, on the senior citizens, And I think the Internet has helped. Well, it provides a level playing field, like we said before.
Very much.
And I can get out there and say what I'm going to say and be heard
right.
a whole lot more than I can be out in the neighborhood.
That's right.
Because around here I'm the little old lady on the corner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and so,
on the Internet,
yeah.
We have a lot of credibility.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough.
Yes.
You know, I never knew. How did you and Kate link up? How did you get going on this?
Kate and I?
Well,
That's old. We've been around a while.
Yeah.
Go,
we were on Second Life. We were on Second Life together. Second Life, where as a where these people, it's like a really weird place where kinds of really we weren't really the kind of people to hang out in Second Life. Let's put it that way. And it's an internet site where it's you know, you download it onto your computer and then you go onto it and you create an avatar, and which is very interesting in light of that movie, The Avatar, too.
Yes, yes.
And you create your own little avatar and applies. And she, mine was Mooey Infinity, and Joan was Moonvine. So this is it, Mooey Infinity, Moo, and Moon, Moo, and you. And the thing is, that's sort of how it all... Well, anyway, we were following a guy by the name of Pat O'Brien, who... What I mean by following, not in any sense of
not
the
guru-y.
Word, I'm not guru-y. Can you imagine him?
Yes, yeah, I remember
but
that.
He's an internet genius.
Right.
And we learned a lot from him, and he had just written a book, and he had decided he was going to promote the book on Second Life. So he brought a bunch of us over there, and it was really a very idyllic situation. We met with him personally late into the night up on this... Well, not him personally. These avatars met with him personally. After a while, you know, you get kind of lost with this whole thing. And we could fly. We talked all kinds of wonderful things. And suddenly, this I think a satanic worship group of people. That's what I mean. This is what I mean when I say people like us really, you know, this is really not us at all.
You
they
had to be careful of wandering around back in those days. I think now they have it a little bit better marked, but back in those days you could end up in some bad spots if you weren't really careful.
And people like us took it very seriously. I mean, you know, I was terrified to just let my avatar go anywhere unprotected.
And
so
rightfully
anyway,
so. I ended up in some weird places sometimes.
Very, very frightening. When I would leave this island that Pat O'Brien had, I would purposely take Mooey Infinity under a fountain and leave her there and make sure, and sort of tuck her in and make sure she was okay. I wouldn't just leave her anywhere.
What?
I mean, I think I was insane. But anyway.
it takes on kind of a life of its own, though.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was real good, and it is real good for the disabled, which has been real interesting, that folks that could not walk began to walk around on Second Life, and somehow it changed the messages in the brain so that some of them could walk again.
What do you mean they began to walk around on Second Life?
Their little avatars.
Second Life, go ahead, Kate.
Their little avatars were walking around, and they were sitting at their computer in a wheelchair, you know, basically thinking that their life was over. And suddenly they opened up nightclubs and danced all night long and stuff like that, and suddenly they got up out of their wheelchair and walked.
Amazing.
Yeah. Isn't that great?
I think it's something we'll see more of that in the future.
That could be a whole new branch of medicine. Wow.
Yeah. Because it was like rewiring the brain somehow.
Exactly, reprogramming. That's amazing.
It ties in with all the imaging stuff,
yeah,
you know.
Right.
It just fascinates me. I loved
it.
I spent entirely too much time out there, but, you know, we had a good time. But anyway, that's where we met.
Yeah, and
well, that's interesting.
Yeah, it was a pretty far out place to meet.
Yeah, it really was. It really was.
Yeah.
We didn't know we were way far ahead of our time. We were just doing what we were told, you know.
So have you met personally now? Have you met person to person now?
Yeah, we did.
Kate came down for our family reunion.
Oh.
We oriented Kate as a Southerner and adopted her.
You live in
South
Carolina?
Yes.
South Carolina. Where in South Carolina?
I'm in Rock Hill, near Charlotte. But the reunion was over at Pendleton, over near Clemson University.
Okay.
Yeah.
When was that?
April.
April 11th or something. Mm-hmm. And you know what? It was really precious. I loved every moment of it. And I got a real, if you read my prayers over that period of time, just read the prayers over the month of April, and you can get an idea of what that was like.
Yeah.
It was,
we really had fun.
I got to warn you that the prayer blog blew up around that time, and I may not have pictures up, so I have to rework. All the written stuff is there, so you can read the month of April and see what that was like. That
that's
was really fun.
Yeah,
but then we left there and went to Seabrook and introduced her to the alligators, too.
Oh, my gosh. I love them. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh.
Only Kate would love the gators.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, they were kind of frightening. You know, you didn't want to meet them. But they ran away from us. That was good.
Yeah, right. I mean, they're not like the Hollywood gators that come after you.
Exactly.
Yeah,
that's when the Free family were here. That's right. They said you had gone down to South Carolina to see Jones.
Who was here?
The Free family, you know, Kirsten and...
Oh, yes. Yes, I missed them completely.
Right. Yeah, they said
you
went to see Jones.
Yeah.
Oh, we had fun. I hope we can do that again, Joan. That was really great.
We've got to do it again, but it was fun. It was
neat.
It was neat, and the whole family just loved Kate, so she was quickly adopted, yes.
Well, I love them, too. I miss them.
It was cool.
Yes, that was really fun.
And something we said we were going to do from way back on those Second Life days. We said one day we will meet. Yep, and we did.
You said coming to the family reunion, and I thought that was a remote possibility. But we kept talking about it, and suddenly it became a reality.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly I was buying a plane ticket, and away I went.
Yeah.
It's also, if you think about it, Kate, I think that's the first time that we talked about you're doing workshops at your house.
I think so.
Wow.
Yes.
So there is the, huh?
Now she's doing them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's something to that real, whatever that is, that's another dimension of this whole technology. I don't know. But really and truly, we did discuss both of those things, I think.
Yeah. And surely it's coming to pass.
It's part reality and part technology. When you're there, and it may, I don't know. I'm not going to try to even talk about it, but I think it's stronger than even we know.
Yeah.
Well, it's very mysterious, isn't it? I mean, there's all this stuff that exists somewhere.
Yeah.
Where does it exist? Where is cyberspace?
Yeah. It's another dimension of life or something.
Right.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah.
It's something that beyond our comprehension now.
Yeah.
Yes.
Of course, it all depends on keeping those lights on.
Yeah, there was some magic happening over there. There really was for a while. Till the bad people took over.
Oh, yeah.
I know. And we couldn't find a better place. I mean,
I guess that's always a part of it.
And they ran us off about... There's no law. There's no law on the internet.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, right. So a lot of people abuse it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that will change, too, in the future. And I just think the world is wide open out there for these kids coming along. My grandchildren will see worlds that we haven't even thought of yet.
I know. It's beautiful. I love it.
Yeah.
Well, we've come to the end.
All right.
Over 90.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much, both of you. It was delightful.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Love you all.
Love you, too.
Thank you.
Glad
good night.
A chance to do it again.
Yes, me too.
Yeah
I agree.
Yeah.
And we'll think about doing the Christmas Carol again, if you don't mind, because I'm not sure if we can just broadcast it.
Look into that. Whether we do it or not, you know, it might be interesting to know whether you can do something like that.
Yeah, I'll find out for sure.
Yeah, but I would think it'd be possible. I don't know. But anyway, we'll think about
it. Yeah, it seems like it would be possible.
Yeah, but otherwise, I'll just do it live again.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, you figure out a date, and we'll go for it.
Well, it'll be close to the solstice. As close as we can get.
Yeah, we'll look into that a little later.
Yeah.
Okay, right. I love you, love you, love you. Sanjala, it was a pleasure to be able to talk to you tonight.
Yes, me too.
Yeah, yeah.
Give my love to Tom, too.
I will. He's at work right now.
What's he doing?
He's teaching credit recovery. And to in other words, these kids, and usually they're much older than kids, they're getting their high school diploma, and instead of getting a GED, they actually go through a graduation.
Oh, uh-huh.
Uh-huh. And he loves it, you know.
Okay,
so.
Yeah.
Yeah, good.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thanks again.
Yes, thank you.
Love you, love you, and good night. I'm going to play the music for Mother and Child, and we'll go on with our night.
Okay.
All right. Good night.
Love you.
Good night, Joan.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.